We're missing some of our brethren who are in Milwaukee, but this morning we look forward to hearing Brother Chris Napshinsky speak to us on the topic of First to Zion, Israel's 70th anniversary. Brother Chris.
Thank you, Brother Peter, and good morning, brethren. Apologize about those words on the screen, but as we get used to our abilities to play the tune that we need to, we realize that sometimes we're a little limited. If we were singing this tune about Zion to the tune of the Hatikva anthem, Israel's anthem, you would be repeating Happy Zion, Happy Zion. But we kind of have to get used to all these different adjustments we have to make. And we're actually trying to think how to name the skeleton that's right outside the door. Someone said it should be Charlie. And that's because it ties to that bumper sticker that the first line says, God is dead, Charles Darwin. And you know what the second line says? Darwin is dead, God. So we will see if this sticks. But at any rate, we thought that this was a non-human skeleton, but I think it is possibly a replica of a human skeleton, so we can get our education on that. But on a more serious note, but not too serious, a happy occasion is upon us. This is the year, the Jewish year, that has just started of Israel's 70th anniversary. You know that the name of the Jewish year is Rosh Hashanah, or as sometimes you would say, Rosh Hashanah. But it does mean the beginning of the year. Rosh is the head, beginning, ha of the the definite article, and shana would be a year. And you know, I was recently learning about the meaning of this word year, and it's very interesting that it actually connects with the word change. So it's kind of intuitive to expect that when a year turns over to the new one, then there's going to be a change, and that's definitely what we always expect. When the year turns over, and we hope to see something new, something good, something very meaningful, perhaps in our lives. So Shana, I have all these different ideas that many different words in our Western languages are connected to Hebrew. So here's my idea, and I just checked with Amelia, not that that's correct, but if Shana. In other words, not that the media would support this theory, but if Shana is connected with the word change, then of course change and Shana kind of sound similar. You have that ash Shana, and as it turns out in French, to say change, it's actually change or something like that. So it's already very close. Well, I'll continue, and I'll be proven either wrong or right on that at some point. But we do have a lot of anniversaries this year. And when you see this first one, 1517, that puts us at 200 years in 2017, I think we all think about Martin Luther and the nailing of his 95 thesis to the door of the church in Wittenberg, right? But there is an anniversary associated with Israel, too. That's a 500-year anniversary. And it's the time, the year, when the Ottomans, the Turkish Ottomans, actually entered into the land of Israel. And so when the, with 1917 and the re-entry of the, of basically the taking over of that land by the British in that time, that was also an anniversary of sorts. But it would be 500 years this year that the Ottomans took over the land of Israel. But 1897, so that's already rolling forward, 120 years this year, was the first Zionist Congress. Now, you know that was before the nation of Israel was established, and in fact, this is a little bit of our focus for our thoughts today, that the Zionists, those who had in their heart and in their minds the love for the land of Israel, or just at least the hope that the nation of Israel can be emancipated, can have their own freedom. They had a number of these congress or conferences in which they agreed on the next steps of what to do. Their leader was Theodor Herzl at the beginning, and this was the year in which this first Zionist Congress was held. So 120 years. 1917, who could not remember the Balfour Declaration, and that's when, and we'll have a picture of that, that's when Lord Balfour from England supported or expresses the support of the Queen for regathering or bringing, opening some doors to the to Israel's more official immigration. Of course, there were a lot of stipulations and other things, but this was definitely a big sign, a big turning point for the Jewish nation's return to be supported by many nations. And now, 1947, you will say, well, what's with 1947? Isn't it 1948 our anniversary that we kind of think about with Israel? Well, it was actually in the late 1947 that the Resolution 181 was voted on and approved by the United Nations. And so, more properly, that momentum to actually proclaim the nation of Israel 6 months or so later in 1948 in the spring was started then. So what you see here is that even though some of these anniversary events, like 1948, it's not exactly 70 years yet because it will be in 2018, but according to the Jewish calendar, which we have just started, the new year just started this Friday, I believe, and this is the year 5778 from the creation of man. So we hope that we will somehow get on the same page with our Jewish friends at some point, but at least they're counting from their chronological counting from the creation of Adam, and that would be the year 5778, but it really gets between our ending of the year 2017 and a big portion of the year 2018. So, of course, 1948, the proclamation of the statehood of Israel, and another interesting anniversary in 2017, and I'm sure you've been watching and perhaps saw the movie about the recapture of Jerusalem in the Six-Day War, and it is the 50th anniversary of the Six-Day War. Somebody was trying to draw an analogy that if we see these kind of round years, if, say, 1917 was 100 years, and then 50 years later, the Six-Day War, that perhaps these cycles that look like almost like a jubilee rhythm may indicate something interesting. Perhaps that is the time when slowly this land, as it was supposed to be on the jubilee year, is returning to Israel. So it remains to be seen, because if indeed we are on that 50-year cycle, are we to expect something interesting ahead of us? But we don't know. What we read is the Scripture's reassurances and wonderful promises. And we start with Amos 9:14, which in King James Bible says, "I will restore the fortunes of my people Israel. And they shall rebuild the ruined cities and inhabit them. They shall plant vineyards and drink their wine. And they shall make gardens and eat their fruit. I will plant them in their land, and they shall never again be uprooted out of the land that I have given them, says the Lord your God." This line, "I will restore the fortunes," in some other translation says, "I will turn away the captivity of my people." And another translation is, "I will change the prospect." I will change the fate, almost. And we like all of these renditions. I think some of the meanings of the Hebrew can probably, you know, support these different alternatives. But it is a big change. And haven't we seen this change since this time? Are we able to comfortably say, yes, these promises are being fulfilled right before us? So there is this wonderful verse in Isaiah 41:27, from which the topic of our discourse is focused, and also another highlight that I wanted to mention. And this phrase is, "First to Zion." And in one translation, this verse says, "The first shall say to Zion, behold, behold them. And I will give to Jerusalem one that brings good tidings." This notion of being first to Zion is very interesting and could be applied to the efforts that went well before the time of establishing the nation, of proclaiming the nation of Israel in 1948. Because as we will realize through some of the biographies that we'll review today, there was a lot of preparation and a lot of talent and a lot of gift that has gone into it. So first to Zion is a beautiful line to think about. And coincidentally, our Polish brethren have thought to prepare a calendar that's a calendar that goes well into the end of 2018. It's the 70 years of the State of Israel first to Zion. And we've been encouraged by the reception that this calendar has had among the Polish brethren. They had printed 1,000 copies. They went like hotcakes. Apparently hotcakes, by the way, for those who don't know, it's also pancakes. So if you don't know what hotcakes is. So anyway, they went like hotcakes, and they are going to be, I think, printing more. Now, we've been approached and actually are working with the brethren to see if we could do a similar project here for in the United States. And we have our first layout. It's still a draft version of the English version. I actually only have the Polish here with me, and you're welcome to review it during the break. But this calendar has biographies of those people that have first and foremost been the leaders, the thought leaders, those who were specialists in various disciplines well before the establishment, the formal establishment of the nation of Israel. And so we'll have a few glimpses of these pages, but just so you know where this is coming from. We're trying to kind of combine this nice anniversary and a little bit of introduction to the content that maybe we'll be able to somehow support with our efforts here in Chicago. So there are I think 13 names, if I'm not mistaken, of those who are listed there, and they are Moses Montefiore, Leon Pinsker, Edmund James the Rothschild, Aaron David Gordon, Eliezer Ben Yehuda, Theodore Herzl, Abraham Isaac Cook, Chaim Bialik, Chaim Weizmann, Shmuel Agnon, Zev Jabotinsky, David Ben-Gurion, and Golda Meir. Now, these are very small names, and we will try to zoom them in a little bit, but not all of them. We realize our time is limited. But perhaps you've heard these names before. Perhaps we are all familiar with them. Some of them have done so much, and perhaps we've been struck by some of the talent and the stimulation that they offered to the Jewish people back in the day when most of the Jews lived outside of the land of Israel. That would be during the 1800s, the early 1900s. And so we are very excited about some of the biographies that we have. But we reflect on one other writer, Abraham Joshua Heschel, who was thinking about how is it that the redemption of Israel is supposed to happen. Will it be through a miraculous occurrence that God and the Messiah will somehow come down and will immediately move people to do the things miraculously? Maybe we'll move the entire nation back to the land. Or will there be some collaboration that has to occur? So here's what he had to say, and I may have shown this before. But he says there are two views concerning the coming of the Messianic era. The one view maintains that the redemption of Israel and the Messiah will appear suddenly from heaven, and that amid miracles and wonders, he will gather the Israelites of the diaspora up to their ancient inheritance. According to the other view, the beginning of the redemption will take place in a natural way by the desire of the Jews to settle in Palestine and the willingness of the nations to help them in their work. Redemption, scholars insisted, was not to be conceived of solely as an act that will come about all at once and without preparation. It is an ongoing, continuous process in which all have a role to play, either retarding or enhancing the process. Not only is redemption a necessity for man, but man is a necessity for redemption, says Heschel. His actions are vital and affect the course of that process. Man holds the key that can unlock the chains fettering the Redeemer. A central concern in Jewish thinking is to overcome the tendency to see the world in one dimension, from one perspective, to reduce history exclusively to God's action and or to man's action, either to grace or to man's initiative. The marvelous and the mundane, the sacred and the secular, are not mutually exclusive, nor are the natural and the supernatural, the temporal and the eternal kept apart. The heart of the relationship of God and man is reciprocity, interdependence. The task is to humanize the sacred and to sanctify the secular. This is what he thought, and I think there is a lot of depth in it, where we can see how the efforts of God and efforts of man work together to bring about a result. And we think that even the rule of freedom of will, you cannot be forced to do something, but if you're a willing actor or a willing participant and a partner, you are so much more both rewarded and motivated and blessed by it. Here is a picture of the Lord Balfour and the letter of the declaration of the Balfour Declaration. I have much pleasure in conveying to you, this is 1917, on behalf of His Majesty's government, the following declaration of sympathy with the Jewish Zionist aspiration, which has been submitted to and approved by the cabinet. Now, among the people that had to do something with encouraging this declaration take place was one man whose name is Chaim Weizmann. He was a scientist. He was a very talented chemist. In fact, who knows if we are not also, as in a certain way, beneficiaries, in quotes, of his invention, because it's quite sure, though, that he did invent the gunpowder and a way to accelerate the explosions, and also to reduce some of the, I think, the fumes that are associated with an explosion. So I think he was also, I think acetone, if I'm pronouncing this correctly, was the chemical that he was very expert in. And so he and through this invention, he gained access to a lot of circles of politicians and a lot of those who were able to make decisions. And he was supporting the Jewish cause, the cause of the nation scattered, persecuted, looked down upon, for some solution, for some answer, and some better future. And so this was his one of the key factors in this Balfour Declaration, was Chaim Weizmann's work. Here in this screen, we have the picture of the Declaration of Independence in 1948. We see David Ben-Gurion standing and reading the Declaration, and I believe Chaim Weizmann is somewhere here, although I'm not sure if I'd be able to tell which one he is, but he became, Chaim Weizmann became Israel's first president, while Ben-Gurion was the first prime minister. So the state of Israel is born. And through all the efforts of these people who have gone before that date to enable, to encourage, and to try to lay the foundations for this wonderful change that was taking place. And many of them came from Eastern Europe. If we look here at the map of this Eastern Europe, we see how this totally does not reflect and show today's map and division of the countries. There's something interesting. I think many of us in this room may have relatives, roots, may have been born in the areas that are on this map. I don't know what it is, but it seems that many of the brethren in these countries have a very good heart for understanding and listening and being curious and interested in the truth. And here I will just highlight a couple of locations which are very special to us. Over here is Kishinev. Kishinev is now in Moldova, and that's where Andrei is from. We have Lublin and Warsaw and those places, like myself. I was born in Warsaw, and all this was in one area called which was part of the so-called Pale Settlement, which was created in the late 1700s when Poland was divided or separated and parceled out to the different three other bigger countries or powers. And so this area was the area where the Jews were allowed to reside. And so a lot of the immigration that came later from Europe was actually from these areas. So those would be the countries currently such as Belarus and Ukraine, all over here, and Moldova, and I'm sure partially Romania, which I think those countries were together, you know, before, and it's the same language. And we've got all the intervening areas here that combine, and the cities that you read about in these biographies are all very much around this area. And I think here's another map of this and these different subdivisions, a little too small probably for us to see. But I think you will recognize this scene from The Fiddler on the Roof, where Tevye sings L'chaim to his new son-in-law, who is probably a little older than him, or very much the same age. Wolf is his name. Suddenly, in the scene, there is a voice that extends beyond the voices of these singers. It's the Russians, the Cossacks, possibly, if this was in the Ukraine, who initially say, "We wish you well. We wish you na zdrovie," as we would say in Russian. And yet, even in this scene, there is a lot of tension. There is that uncertainty. Do you really wish us well? Do you really, as the residents of this area, wish us well? And Anatevka, even though I think it's a real village, it really is a combination of the various areas and experiences of the Jews from the Eastern Europe. These areas became fell to pogroms, which would be massive destruction of Jewish property and the murder of many hundreds, sometimes Jews, right in the early 1900s. So it's a very meaningful scene that you can recall and play for yourself. Now, when you go into the land of Israel, we see that a lot of those who live there, a lot of the next generations, are the descendants of those who very early on decided to move to Israel and to respond to this call for returning. And so we'll try to play a clip from one service called Ask an Israeli, Ask a Palestinian. And I was hoping that that the image would be a little bigger, but hopefully you will be able to see something. Where are your parents from? My mother is from Nahalal. And where are your grandparents born? Rishon LeZion. My father's parents were from Poland. And my grandmother came to Israel at the beginning of World War II. My grandfather towards the end of the war. And why did they come? They were Zionists, pioneers, friends in a Zionist youth group. They attended pioneer training, the other side of your family, or the other side. My grandfather was born in Israel, but his parents came from the second Aliyah, which is like early 1900s. 1880s, no, early 1900s. In the first decade of the 20th century. From where did they come? What today is Ukraine. So they also came for Zionist reasons. They were very Zionist and were friends in youth groups in Europe and then came here to settle in the land of Israel. Also, my grandmother's parents came in the third Aliyah. What ethnic group are you from? Come over here and stand on this side. My name is Humus Levinsky. I am half Tunisian, half Moroccan on both sides. I assume they came here in 1950s, is that right? So why did they come? Wow, they waited Their entire dream was to go to Israel. What do you mean, their dream? Their dream, their parents' parents. They're always prayed to go to Israel. You mean in every generation, every generation. Okay, and such is the story of many, many people who now reside in Israel. I have to say that what's very peculiar and very interesting when you hear and listen to these interviews is that these people are so engaged and so involved in the developments in their country, and so you're both emotionally and intellectually connected with it. And it is a wonderful example, I think, to us, you know, at any place, to be able to speak for the reason for your life, for your life's decisions, even in our, you know, Christian walk, obviously. So we read in Exodus 35:35, he has filled them with skill to perform every work. And that's, of course, a reference to the tabernacle. And we think about the talented people that were contributing to the tabernacle creation and all the works. And we think that something like this could be also very applicable to the times of the preparation for the establishment of the nation of Israel. They had the different categories, the language and writing, the connection, the necessity for people to communicate, the glue that keeps it together, the land development, the financial support which has to be there, the Zionist thought leadership, the ability to organize people and to govern, and to provide for ideas for self-defense, for defense, for organized ways to defend yourself against the enemy, and to lead people, to encourage them in dedication to God. And such were the lives of many of these people. They were dedicated to one of these areas. Now, the first one that I'm sure we will all remember, because very recently even Brother David Stein had a discourse about Eliezer ben Yehuda, about the creation of the Hebrew, of restanding of the Hebrew language. Or Chaim Bialik, who was a poet, who is now a very well-beloved poet. He wrote a beautiful poem, ode to the, to the bird, which we will try to play here in a minute. Or Shmuel Yosef Agnon, who was the first Nobel Prize winner and who built up the Hebrew vocabulary. And on the January page of the calendar, you will find the biography of Eliezer ben Yehuda, and this anecdote. That was after ben Yehuda already came to Israel after many decades of his work on rebuilding the Hebrew language. And he, by the way, he wrote prepared a 16-volume dictionary of Old and New Hebrew, and it would be very interesting to see what that looks like. But anyway, here's the anecdote. In one of the narrow streets of the 19th century Jerusalem, a certain young Jewish journalist from Europe met a pair looking like European Jews, but speaking some strange language. "What language is this?" he asked them in Yiddish. That's not Hebrew. The man answered, "Hebrew." The young man was surprised. "How come? Hebrew is a dead language." "You are mistaken, my friend," replied the man. "Myself and my wife are very much alive, and so Hebrew cannot be dead." And I think this was Eliezer ben Yehuda, who dedicated his life and his faithful wife, who accompanied him all the years, to prepare, rebuild, and educate all the Jewish people so that they could speak this one language. And I heard one comparison recently from a Jewish speaker who said that in the 1800s or early 1900s, you could combine all the people who knew how to speak Hebrew in a large school building, for example. All people in the whole world, because Hebrew was used just for liturgy, and they could not have probably communicated, you know, very fluently. But what do we have today? We have over 7 million people living in Israel who are fluent in this language. This language came back to life, and it was necessary. And we see how the Lord's guidance was over this process to set that spark early on, to prepare the materials and the ways to learn and study. And there are wonderful stories about people mentoring and teaching one another, of which we don't have time to dwell on. And it was the Torah and tradition that has kept this nation together and has kept it kept it so faithful and able to receive the call at the end of this time of their diaspora to return. And we're going to play a short clip from Rabbi Beryl Wine, who we know otherwise from many different lectures. I know Brother Mark appreciates some of the lessons he has. He's going to talk about Torah and tradition for just a minute.
In view of the Jewish people, you realize that the glue that held us together has been enabled us to survive till today, and the fact that we loyal to Torah and loyal to tradition. And that really is what helped create the state of Israel. Without it, it could never have been created. Now comes the new idea that none of this is necessary. So if you look at it in view of your long-term history, it's absolutely suicidal. So the only thing that worked for us is what you want to discard now.
So what he's saying here, if you could hear it, and I was really hoping his images would be bigger. YouTube has kind of changed some things, and we have to learn how to do it better. But he basically says it was through the Torah and tradition. There was this beautiful picture of the children reading Hebrew, probably in a shiva or a heder, which would be like an early education school. But he says that what kept us together and kept us alive as a nation now is being questioned, perhaps by some modern thought, you know, in Israel, and a little bit of a secular draw. And he says, this would be, if this is what kept us together, the opposite of this would be suicidal. So we definitely want to pay attention to that and see where this trend goes, and wish that this will be a good development, continuing good development for the nation of Israel. Here is a short biography of Chaim Bialik, who is a talented poet who is beloved by many, whose poems, even though he only wrote about 130 of them, are quite popular and played and recited many times. And he settled in the land of Israel in 1924. There were many thousands of people who came before 1948, but it was through the inspiration of these leaders that they were able to be encouraged to take these steps. Here is the Ode to the Bird, and we'll just reflect on the meaning of this. This is the scene that he's describing is that as someone living in those remote countries, he's visited by a little bird, and he's welcoming this bird because he thinks this bird is coming from the land of Israel, and he's coming with some messages, with some stories from that land of which is so dear to everyone who loves this hope of Israel. Welcome upon your return, sweet bird, from the warm countries to my window. How my soul longs to hear your pleasant voice in winter when you leave my dwelling. And I'll just try to see if I can play this, and you will hear the melody that was written for it. It's very beautiful. And you could possibly read those words if they're large enough as well. Does the dew descend as pearls on Mount Hermon? Does it come down and fall like tears? My tears have dried up and hope is fled. There is no end to my grief. Greetings upon your return, my dear bird. Raise your voice and shout. And it seems that it was just like this bird who was to raise his voice and shout, that these people were motivated to shout. They were motivated to alert their brethren to do something about their condition and to emancipate themselves. And among them were many such leaders that were attempting to help with what they could, with whatever talents they had, in the area of land development and finance. Moses Montefiore, Edmund James the Rothschild, or Aaron David Gordon. They all had ways in which they supported the nation by their own either ability to provide the funds or ability to set an example. As, of course, you will recognize the name, the Rothschild name, which is a very rich Jewish family, with all the criticism and, of course, jealousy that comes from many different directions, you know that the Lord had a special tool in his hand that was necessary at the time. And Edmund James, the Rothschild, created and supported a lot of different vineyards and organizations and kibbutzim that were just simply the must-have for that beginning of that time. And we have a little picture of Edmund James the Rothschild, and we do have a little quote from Rabbi Wein, and we'll just try to play just a few minutes because I think the time is rushing us. The Lovers of Zion.
And the task of the Lovers of Zion was to support the Jewish population in the land of Israel and to encourage other Jews to emigrate and come to the land of Israel. This organization was not only composed of religious Jews and rabbis, but it was also composed of secularist Jews, such as Dr. Neil Pinsker, the author of the famous book Auto-Emancipation, which dealt with the fact that the Jewish people themselves could solve their problem with the exile and emancipate themselves. The organization actually needed money. What Jewish organization does not need money? And therefore, the secretary of the organization undertook a bold move. He went to Paris to speak to Baron Edmund de Rothschild from the famous Rothschild family, and to ask his aid in somehow supporting this organization of the Lovers of Zion. Now, the Lovers of Zion is the forerunner of today's Jewish agency or the Israeli Immigration Department. And the Baron Rothschild is the first of many Jewish philanthropists, though he is known as the Nadim HaYadua, the philanthropist, but he's the forerunner of many Jewish philanthropists who helped build the land of Israel and to a great extent helped create the state of Israel as it exists today.
Rothschild lived in Paris, France, and his other family members were in other big cities of Europe. Maybe they did not visit too frequently. Maybe they were remotely supporting this great effort, but their heart and their desire was to do something meaningful in their life, and this is how they were able to contribute. We go on to those who led the leadership of Zionist thought, government, and defense. Here the names would be Leon Pinsker. He was mentioned in this previous soundbite, Theodor Herzl, Chaim Weizmann, Golda Meir, David Ben-Gurion, and Zev Jabotinsky. We won't have time to talk about them in detail, but in this calendar, there is a page, actually an article dedicated to Theodor Herzl. It's very interesting to see how the whole spectrum of those who were the leaders in the Zionist idea, how they kind of went from one more secular draw, where they were not very interested even in the land of Israel, but they just wanted to create an ability for this nation to be regathered wherever it would be, Madagascar or Uganda or other areas. And then concurrently with, and Herzl was probably a little more on that secular side, and concurrently with Herzl, there were others who in their yeshivas, in those schools, were deciding, no, this has got to be it. This has got to be the land of Israel. That's where we're supposed to be regathered. And so all these trends, all these currents were converging to arrive at this idea that this is where the return needs to happen. So we mentioned Herzog, Weizmann, David Ben-Gurion, whose life is a wonderful example of dedication to supporting the immigration of the Jews. When he saw the Holocaust, when see what was happening, he was determined, and he was already in Israel. He had been in Israel for a number of decades by then. He was determined to bring his brethren and to make sure that they are able to settle and to enable that. And so he was the first prime minister of nation of Israel. And here is Golda Meir, who is also referred to as the mother of the nation of Israel. Someone could say the grandmother, because she was in her 70s when she became Israel's prime minister. She was actually the first female prime minister ever in the world. So Margaret Thatcher or others would be kind of after her. We want to be very respectful of the example that the Jewish people have set. And she wrote a book, My Life. It's a memoir of things that have happened in her life. But it's very interesting that she was brought up in... she was born in Ukraine, just like the others in that map, but she emigrated to the United States. I'm sure we know that. She spoke perfect English, even though she left for Israel in her 20s, and that was after her husband died. And she had lived in Wisconsin, so we're thinking of our Milwaukee brethren. She is a fantastic example of this dedication to the idea of Israel. I think one of the things that you will find about her biography is that she had like this sense of the family. That for her, this yeshuv or the settlers were like one big family. And in fact, when she became prime minister, she made things apparently very pleasant and very home-like. Apparently the cabinet met in her kitchen, and frequently she was standing at the stove. But we do have a little clip. However, before we play it, you will see here Golda Meir was one of the signatories of the Declaration of Independence. There are 37 signatories, and Golda was one of them. Here's a little clip from a 1973 interview, and she speaks here about the differences between the times when Israel started, when there were 650,000 people total in Israel in 1948, and the modern days when there are 800,000 people, children in schools, and how things have changed. But just listen to her tone of wisdom and experience.
All this without the fact that once in a month, I could say almost about once in a day at least. Now, because of the fact that it happened in this, so war in this area is something that is critical to Israel and to the enemy. Peace, if it comes and when it comes, is very important situation for Israel.
Very good. I think we have a sense of her personality and her, and I think many of us remember her as well, and we just appreciate that this talent and this role was given to somebody. She was instrumental in obtaining large amounts of funds from the United States and from Russia when those first days in 1948. When the defense funds were needed, when certain purchases were needed. So as we summarize our lessons here, and there are many beautiful stories, we see that this is a multi-anniversary opportunity and situation for us this year. We see the 500, 120, 100, 50 years. This is a meaningful year, and I wonder if the Lord has something in mind for this year for the nation of Israel, or maybe a beginning of a new chapter. Sometimes it's a test. Sometimes it's a chapter that may basically evaluate how well things have progressed. And we want to keep our eyes open. We see that the Zionists led, encouraged, provoked, and were a wonderful example. What a lesson for us in our Christian walk to become a spark for somebody else, to find some sort of a niche that in our spiritual development we might say, this is it. This is what I can do to encourage my brethren. There's a bit of this kind of premonition and like intuition that these people had. You know, when one of them, I think it was Pinsker, who was going around in the 1930s and telling, 1938, telling his Jewish brethren, listen, you see what Hitler is doing? We have no time to waste. They kind of ignored him. They did not mostly follow him. And as you know, the consequence, unfortunately, was very sad. But it was those people that kind of had this spark, that intuition, anticipating and seeing a little more of the reality. Just like perhaps we as Christians, we see a little more of that spiritual reality. Can we encourage one another? Can we encourage those who are our friends to see that and to maybe take some steps to be in a different, better position in their life? We see that the great talents converged. The management of talents was probably by the Lord's doing. There was a lot of spiritual stimulation. They were trying to fight apathy. And the question of are we ready? Are we keeping our eyes open to whatever the Lord might be doing, both with the nation of Israel and what our role, what our participation might be as his people and brethren under the same father of believers, Abraham? Or is there something that we need to do still in our lives? And what kind of lessons we can draw from these? So these are some areas for our encouragement and our conversation. Again, we have this calendar that we'd like to make available to both the brethren and even send to the Jewish some Jewish organizations in a way to congratulate and acknowledge that we are a very respectful group of believers who appreciate God's promises to Israel, and by faith we see that those promises are being fulfilled, and we want to wish our brethren who have so many projects associated with Israel, this year's trip, and all the efforts that go in Israel with the tabernacle model. We want to wish them continuing blessing and wisdom from the Lord, and may you be blessed as you continue. And as the Jews would say, L'shana tova, to a good year, or as we would say, to something good that will change. Maybe it will change us, maybe it will be a change for the world. And may we have our eyes and hearts open. May the Lord add his blessing.